This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today we have Professor Gordon Wood on to talk about his most recent book, Friends Divided, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Gordon Wood is one of our best professors of the American founding. He's the Alva O. Way University Professor at Brown University. His many books have won numerous prizes, including the Pulitzer and Bancroft Prize. Glad to have him back on the program. We interviewed him maybe a year ago on a collection he edited for the Library of America, the Pamphlets Debate of the American Revolution. Gordon Wood, glad to have you on the program.
Glad to be back, Ricky.
So wonderful reading this book, and it brought to mind, you know, I first encountered your scholarship as an undergraduate. I read The Creation of the American Republic, and thinking about these two men, Jefferson and Adams, and sort of the immense political founding of our country, which did so much to reshape, I think, or not to reshape, but shape the course of the way we think about equality and liberty and Republican constitutionalism. I'm going to ask you, Friends Divided, what got you interested in the relationship of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson?
Well, I was originally going to do a book on Adams because I had just completed for the Library of America the third volume of Adams's writings, and I was very familiar with what he had written over his career. But my editor at Penguin suggested, why don't you compare him to Jefferson? And suddenly it hit me that would be interesting, and I'm glad I followed his suggestion, because I think by pitting the two men against one another, it clarified, for me at least, the differences between them, and I think it improved my understanding of both men.
You, these two men, opposite in so many ways, and you move chronologically in the book over the course of their lives and careers, their backgrounds so dramatically different. Talk about that and what might actually, you know, bring them together. Obviously, you know, the resistance, the separation, and the fight for independence are a huge part of that. But they do become, in fact, friends. Maybe, how do these two opposite men find one another?
Well, they were different. They came from different backgrounds. They were different in temperament. They differed in every conceivable way. You can't imagine how different they could be. But they did agree on the revolution, and they were both radicals. Both in the Continental Congress, taking leads, especially Adams. Jefferson wasn't quite the orator that Adams was, but he certainly was radical. And that's what bonded them, I think, at the outset, the revolution. Of course, over the course of their career, they did have one big thing in common, their deep and abiding hatred of Alexander Hamilton, which united them. But they differed in every way.
Think about this question, though, of the Continental Congress. So they're two radicals. They come more quickly than others to the realization that America will have to separate from Great Britain.
Yes.
Yes.
Jefferson's pamphlet that he wrote in 1774, which was actually instructions to his delegation, the Virginia delegation, he would have gone, but I think he became ill, and so he sent along a written account of how he felt about the relationship with Great Britain. And it got published by his delegation, and turned out to be the most radical pamphlet then written. It was the most radical pamphlet until Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And he came very close. He didn't call the king a royal brute as Paine did, but he came very close to delegitimizing the monarchy, which nobody quite had done before in the pamphlet war.
I want to think about this a quotation from Benjamin Rush, and maybe you can tell us who Benjamin Rush was and how he figures into this story in your book, Friends Divided. But he described John Adams and Thomas Jefferson as the North and South Poles of the American Revolution. What was Rush getting at with that quote?
Well, he saw these two men as the giants, as two of the giants. Of course, the great giant, of course, was Washington, but the other two giants were Adams and Jefferson, and they both each stood for their section, and I think that's how they were seen by many people. And Rush was the physician, probably the leading physician, doctor, in the Revolutionary era. Close friend of both men, although much closer, I think, to Adams than he was to Jefferson. But he is the man who, in 1812, brought these two men who had been estranged for 12 years because of the election of 1800. He brought them back together. He worked at it for 2 years and worked at it hard to bring them back together because he thought they needed to speak to the nation and represent the two sections, in a sense, to the fellow Americans about what the revolution was about.
So Rush's thinking and bringing them together, this is something for the country as a whole.
Oh,
there needs
definitely
to be some sort of a union between these two men, and it would be good for citizens of that time to see it.
And Rush was a Pennsylvanian, which was the middle colony, the dominant middle colony, so it was appropriate that he would be the one who would bring these two, the northerner and the southerner, together.
You know, thinking about similarities between Adams and Jefferson, you talk a lot in the book about the Virginia that Jefferson is born into, forms him and, you know, to which gives him an elevated status. And yet he is at war with that in many respects in his political writings. Adams comes from a society certainly where there's rank and some amount of nobility. But it is much more along the lines, I think, of what America will aspire to be, which is something like a middle class society. And Adams is within that, although Adams is not, you know, he's not rags to riches, but he's certainly not of the highest rank of Massachusetts. Does that sort of talk about, put them together for us in the sense of what they're thinking about economically, politically, and human nature in that regard?
Yeah, I think that it's a fascinating story when you think about it, that the most radical elements in the Revolutionary era, going up into the 1790s, are the Southern slaveholding planters. I mean, yeah. If we talk about limousine liberals, then that's what we've got. and the Federalist Party is centered in New England, which is by far, and the Federalists, of course, stood for hierarchy, stood for a conservative party. They're frightened of democracy. They come from the area that is most egalitarian and most popular and most democratic. Well, the paradox, I think, is explained by the fact that because the North is or New England is more democratic, then the people are more frightened of democracy. Whereas in the South, these planters' position was so assured, they were so confident of their position that they could be, as we say, limousine liberals. They could easily accept democracy because they didn't fear it. They didn't have the same kind of competitive elections that you had in Massachusetts. Jefferson never lost an election in his life. Adams knew he did lose one, and he knew what democracy was like, and he was frightened of it. He did not like democracy. He's a Federalist. He's not a hardline Hamiltonian Federalist, but he is certainly on the side of the Federalist Party compared to the radical Jeffersonian Republicans.
Yeah, this kind of sparks a question in my mind. Both men think long and hard about political constitutions, Republican constitutions, and how they would fit and relate into the political circumstances of the colonies, the newly independent states, and America as a country. Part of that was thinking about state constitutions. And
well,
both are influencing, both, you know, Adams in Massachusetts, Jefferson, Virginia. Maybe talk about that as sort of a key to their political thinking.
Well, both of them, of course, are Republicans. That is to say, they do not believe in hereditary rule and and monarchism, and they want to establish popular government. Although Adams comes to doubt popular government and does lean towards some hereditary factors, he assumes that some sooner or later America will have to adopt monarchical type institutions. That is for the presidency and for the Senate. But they're radicals, but Jefferson is by far the more radical. He has an utter confidence in the people. He believes in popular elections and in a way that Adams does not. He's less as he says, I fear the one, meaning the monarchy, and you, Adams, fear the few. And Adams would agree with that. He had a real mistrust of oligarchy, of aristocrats. But, of course, he thought that they were inevitable, so therefore you should build in corrections, limits on power. He is more than any other single founder responsible for separation of powers and for the restraints on power, for the veto of the that's given to the governors, Massachusetts governor, and then later, of course, adopted by the presidential for the presidency in the convention of Philadelphia in 1787. So Adams is terribly influential because of the Massachusetts Constitution on constitutionalism in America.
So I want to come back to this in a minute. Adams on monarchy and Adams on aristocracy, because I think it's a really important part of his thought. But Jefferson's Virginia Constitution, both his notes on the state of Virginia, but also what he's able to contribute to the actual state constitution that gets adopted in the wake of independence.
Yeah, he proposes a constitution for Virginia. It doesn't have too much effect because it arrives too late. But his conception, of course, is a very weak executive, which he calls an administrator, and that's it. His executive is stripped of all prerogative powers, no power to veto legislation, no power of appointment to offices, and as he rightly calls him, he says he's a mere administrator. He doesn't go as far as the Pennsylvanians, the radical Pennsylvanians, who do away with the executive altogether, but he certainly is the most anti-monarchical person in Virginia among his colleagues, and he is far more radical than most of them. He wants to give 50 acres of land to all white people who don't have that much, so that he would have the broadest possible suffrage for the Virginia elections. So he's just an out-and-out radical in the late 18th century. Of course, being radical meant minimal government. You feared government. So he isn't quite progressive by today's standards, but in the context of the late 18th century, he is about as progressive as you could be and still be an elected official. His views and Thomas Paine's are indistinguishable. It's just that Paine wrote them out more explicitly and of course, got into trouble because of that. Jefferson's more discreet, but they don't differ in any way in their views of what the proper government should be.
So I think Jefferson, and no end of writing, as you know, on his idea of natural aristocracy. So he's also thinking about aristocracy. And he, I think it's fair to say he's intent on and does wipe out sort of legal boosts or artificial creations of aristocracy, but very much in favor of talent through Republican education,
right,
and circumstances being sort of a way that the best would actually protect liberty or protect sort of the society he wants to see come into being.
Yes, he believes that the electorate, once educated, democratic electorate, will elect the likes of him, people who are talented, who have virtue. He just has trust in the people's judgment, and that the aristocrats will be men of talent and men of virtue. And he's confident of that because he lives in a society where those Virginian leaders generally were quite extraordinary when you think of it. Only 300,000 white inhabitants, and yet they produced that galaxy of
yeah,
leaders going all the way from Jefferson to John Marshall to George Mason and George Washington and so on. So it's an extraordinary moment in Virginia history. And he's confident that the people will be will be intelligent enough to do that. Adams has no confidence whatsoever. He said his aristocracy is going to be whoever gets elected, and they have to be demagogues, they have to be rich men without intelligence, without virtue. He knows there's going to be an oligarchy running things, but he says that it's not an oligarchy you could trust, because it's going to be the wiliest kinds of guys who can make it to the top. And so he's got a deep mistrust of democracy.
Thinking about, and Adams certainly not unique in that regard. Adams, though, does he see aristocracy? Is it, it's inevitable and it's therefore going to be bad, or it's inevitable and therefore how does one shape it politically, socially, to actually serve a good end for a republic?
Well, he thinks it's inevitable. He has an iron law of oligarchy, and those oligarchs are going to be dangerous, and so you've got to limit them somehow. His idea was to ostracize them in the upper houses of the governments. That's where it's a little bit naive. How are you going to be sure that they're going to stay in the upper house? But he thought that if you just put them in these upper houses, the Senates, whether at the federal or at the state level, that somehow they would be isolated and kept in check, particularly by a strong governor or a strong executive. He favors a very strong executive, which differs greatly from what Jefferson felt. Jefferson, of course, is fearful of strong executive authority and wants that limited, whereas Adams is keen on enhancing the executive in order to check the oligarchs who are going to be, he hopes, isolated in the Senate.
So you say, thinking about that, so I was thinking about your earlier comments on the Massachusetts state constitution, which you said he has a tremendous effect on, and then this more sort of concern about democracy, intense concern about democracy and aristocracy as well. So, but kind of cash that out for us, because doesn't he, it seems to me he contributes, though, to one of the most democratic constitutions of the period.
You mean the Democratic Constitution of Massachusetts?
Yes.
Well, I don't think it was considered to be democratic. I think it was considered to be the most conservative constitution. It comes late. The other constitution.
But it doesn't seem, I guess, yeah, maybe I poorly worded that. It doesn't seem, though, and just listening to you talk, though, I'm just sort of thinking the Senate ostracized the upper house. Do we find that sort of concern in the Massachusetts state constitution?
Yes, very much so. The property qualifications were very high for membership and for the electorate. There's a different electorate for the upper house in Massachusetts, and property qualifications which would confine the members to a very rich group, with also a strong executive. That is, he gives the what Adams wanted for the governor, of course, was a absolute veto. He's thinking in terms of the British Constitution, where the king, at least theoretically, had an absolute veto. He's part of the legislature, and that's what he wanted. But his colleagues in the convention in Massachusetts in 1779-80 wouldn't go that far, but they do create what we now are familiar with, a limited veto, that is a qualified veto, which can be overridden by two-thirds of the legislature. Adams is disappointed with that change that is made by his colleagues, but it is the model that's picked up by the federal convention, and it's become, I think, what we now take for granted in the state level as well. That is, the governors have a veto, but it's a limited veto. They can be overridden. That veto can be overridden. That's not quite what Adams wanted, but at least he was strong in arguing for a veto to limit the legislature. But his constitution is about as conservative in light of the other constitutions as you could get, with the strong property qualifications. Now, and a strong judiciary, an independent judiciary. So he's really thinking in terms of trying to limit democracy without repudiating republicanism, of course. His colleagues would not have allowed him to go that far. He was much more conservative than his colleagues or the convention, his fellow convention, Massachusetts convention people. But he in no way is you know, anti-democracy. anti-Republican at that point.
Now, so I want to, because you make this argument, I think, in the book, that he does sort of turn in certain respects and become open to hereditary forms of government, monarchy, maybe more rooted, as you say, or as you quoting Adam, maybe more rooted in human nature than actual Republican government. And so maybe talk about that, because I thought that was...
Well, he becomes so frightened of the French Revolution that he begins writing his... he not only writes a defense of the state constitutions, which is a defense against the unicameralism that the French philosophes, where he considered them absolute fools, get caught up in, but he begins writing his Dabbler essays in 1790-91. The last essay he writes is quite radical. That is, it's quite, I should say, conservative, in the sense that he actually thinks that our elections will become so faction-ridden, so corrupt, that we will have to turn to the Senate and the Senates and the executives being serving for life. And then eventually, he says, that we'll have to make them hereditary. That's such a radical paper that Jefferson's appalled by it, and he never forgets it. He always remembers that. Adams has some second thoughts when his essays are collected together and published in 1805. That's quite a bit later from 17, where they were written, collected together. He leaves that essay out. And so, and of course, his grandfather, when he edited his papers in the middle of the 19th century, left it out too. So you don't get as full a picture of Adams if you read just the published papers edited by Charles Francis Adams, his grandson, because that essay is left out. But it's a very important essay, and it shows how despairing Adams had become, at least in the early 1790s. Now, by 1805, I think he realized that that was probably going too far, and he kept that paper
is
back.
Is that your assessment of
yeah,
of
that,
the
well,
essay?
Yeah,
that
it was... he never explains what. Okay. No one ever explains why that essay was left out. But I'm sure that it was just too far. He went too far. A kind of a statement that was just a bridge too far, if you will. Yeah. Saying that we're going to have hereditary offices. That really was out of touch with
So the discourses on Davila, who is Adams writing that for? An American audience, or?
Yeah, I think at that point he's writing for an American audience. It was published in America. It's not. It's no longer the international audience that he had in mind with, or the French audience that he had in mind. Although he expected them to, he hoped that they might read it too, because he felt that the French Revolution was people gone crazy. He has real misgivings of the French Revolution right from the outset. I mean, he's like Burke. In fact, he's one of the few Americans who praises Burke's condemnation of the Revolution, which was quite early on. And he's opposed to the French Revolution because he thinks these philosophes are crazy. They're just living in clouds. They're a bunch of utopian thinkers. And he tells Jefferson that, and he thinks Jefferson is part of that crowd. They don't confront each other directly, but you know what they think of each other because you read them saying things about the other to other people.
Well, now, as I read your book on the French Revolution, I'm thinking, events, history, circumstances pretty much bore Adams' judgment out, though. I think on the French Revolution.
Oh, well, I think that's true. And he, you know, by 18, when they're corresponding with each other after the reconciliation that's brought about by Rush, Adams has a facetious and a kind of ribbing nature. He likes to needle. He's got a that kind of personality. And Jefferson puts up with it because Jefferson values the relationship, and he puts up with Adams's facetiousness. But at that point, in 1815, for example, the Bourbons back on the throne. Napoleon's been defeated at Waterloo, and the Bourbons are actually back on the throne. And here you have Jefferson, Adams saying to Jefferson, "So, what do you think of the French Revolution now, Mr. Jefferson?" I mean, that's kind of needling. And Jefferson puts up with it because he's also polite, and he's obsessed with politeness, and he doesn't like confrontations, and he's not going to endanger the relationship. Adams goes pretty far and saying things, but at the same time, he avoids the most controversial subject of all. He never provokes Jefferson on slavery. He never needles him on slavery, which he could easily do.
No,
they talk about the subject as a consequence of the Missouri crisis, but Adams is very discreet, which is unusual for him because he's usually not discreet, but he knows better.
Doesn't he? I thought in some other discourse later in life, he did challenge Jefferson directly over slavery. Am I wrong?
Well, he says that I'm opposed to slavery, and you know, I know, and he knows how bad it is, and he says it's going to break up, if anything breaks up the Union, it'll be slavery. But he does say to Jefferson, and that's crucial, he says, look, more or less, you guys, you planters, have the problem, and I'm not going to get in the middle of it. I'm going to let you work it out. That's okay. More or less the line that that Adams takes. He's willing to, he knows, he lets Jefferson know very clearly where his stand is, but he doesn't preach to him and say, you know, you're a bunch of slaveholding aristocrats. He doesn't make that kind of charge.
Yeah. So we've been talking about Adams maybe going a little bit too far and thinking about hereditary forms of government in America. Jefferson, though, in the French Revolution, seems to me, and we've been kind of talking around this, the French Revolution reveals how different these two men are, I think, politically. Jefferson,
right.
I would argue, particularly with one piece of correspondence in particular, goes way too far in supporting the French Revolution and seems...
Oh, yes, the letter
totally,
to...
Totally naive to what political ideology can
right,
do to
exactly.
people.
Exactly. 1793, yeah. In February, I think it is, he writes to his protege, who has succeeded him as minister, who writes... back to William Short, writes back to Jefferson, Mr. Jefferson, your friends, your aristocratic friends are being guillotined by the hundreds and thousands here. And Jefferson writes this extraordinary letter where he says, look, if only an Adam and Eve are left alive but left free, it'll be worth it. In other words, all the bloodshed. And this is, you know, Conor Cruz O'Brien, who was the Irish... journalist and historian, wrote a book about Jefferson in 1990s, and he was appalled when he read that letter, and he says, my God, this makes Jefferson the Pot Paul of the 18th century. You know, Pot Paul being the Cambodian leader who killed millions on behalf of the communist cause. Well, Jefferson did believe strongly. Now, he probably would not have implemented that kind of belief, but he certainly took that radical line.
And, yeah. No, I thought, you know, as I was reading your book, I mean, the thought came to me, and I think, and you have this quote on page 269. So Short writes to Jefferson from Europe, and he's telling that his former French friends were being guillotined. And Jefferson's response is, was ever such a prize won with so little innocent blood? And then you kind of talk,
right.
And then you've sort of given us the longer quotation about, you know, even if Adam and Eve were the only persons left, it would still be better.
Right, right.
But it starts, so Jefferson, I mean, and I've wondered this, Jefferson is sort of like the beginning of the modern intellectual there who sees humanity but doesn't see particular people. Maybe.
Oh no, he's an ideologue. He's caught up just, and in that sense, Conor Cruz O'Brien was absolutely right that he's somebody who's so caught up in the radical vision that he doesn't think about the implications of what he's saying. Of course, Americans did not have that kind of bloodshed, and he was certainly not killing people. But he was a radical, and he believed in his cause, but he thought America was kind of naturally Republican and already democratic, and therefore we didn't have to go through the bloodshed of the French. But he certainly felt that they were justified in doing what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And And then, of course, in the long run, you could say, well, you know, that last letter that Jefferson, one of the last letters he writes, in response to the group in Washington that asked him to come and celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, he says, I'm too ill to do that. But he writes this letter, look, the rights of man are becoming clear to everyone. He foresees a future. He says it's sooner or later that Europe will be free. And of course, in the long run, he was right. Europe, France did become democratic, and Europe did throw off monarchy. It took a long time. As late as 1848, the 1848 revolutions, Republican revolutions, all failed, which is the context for Lincoln's statement that we're the last best hope because the failure of democracy in Europe. But in the long run, Jefferson did foresee a democratic future, and he represents that kind of impulse that sooner or later the oppression will be removed from the backs of people.
Maybe in
and
light
that's
of
what he stood for.
Yeah, you know, maybe in light of as Edmund Burke referred to the French Revolution, the armed ideology that it gave life to, and we think about World War One. And sort of armed ideologies and forming national governments, and then obviously what happens in the 20th century with communism and fascism.
Right.
We're going to need Adams as well. thinking about their friendship here, the falling out. I'm interested in your assessment of how Jefferson opposes Adams when he's president. It seems to me he takes things too far there. What do you think?
Well, yes, I think he and the Republicans are, well, you have to realize they don't know the future, and Jefferson and his Republican followers are sincerely frightened by what they see the Federalists, or they think the Federalists are doing. Hamilton is trying to build a fiscal military state in the British image, and they think that this is bringing back monarchy to America. Now, because we didn't end up doing that, it's very hard to take them seriously, and many historians have dismissed these Jeffersonian Republican fears as foolishness. Well, it's difficult to appreciate that people at the time, not knowing the future, really thought it was possible to reverse a revolution, and I think that's what Jefferson feared. And so his fears are real, but he overdoes it. And in light of what happened, they went too far. And of course they get their comeuppance when it turns out that Adams, I think his most courageous act is to send a mission to France in 1799 to head off and to end the quasi-war with France. But the Jeffersonian Republicans are truly frightened, and of course they take steps that seem to be truly frightening to the Federalists, and that is the invasion of the United States by France. Now, after all, Napoleon is invading countries all over Europe in the 1790s and setting up puppet republics. Well, the Federalists fear that France is going to do the same thing to the United States with the backing of these fifth columnists, these Jeffersonian Republicans. So you've got mutual fears on both sides, which are, if you get a historian's view of it, these fears are legitimate.
Yes.
And therefore, the reaction to the Federalists of the Alien Sedition Acts, which of course have destroyed their reputation historically, but are quite understandable given the fear of a French invasion. And it's not out of the question that France could invade the United States. They had invaded, after all, earlier during the Revolution. They'd crossed the Atlantic and come into the new United States to fight on behalf of the United States. So the fears are real on both sides, and I think helps explain why people behave the way they did. Now, it turns out that there was no possibility of a French invasion. And, of course, Napoleon's defeat at the Battle of the Nile by by Nelson destroyed the French fleet. So there was, once that happened in October of 1799, then there was no fear of any revolution, any invasion. But up to that point, it seemed real. And Hamilton is organizing an army of 50,000 men on paper, at least. Washington comes out of retirement and buckles on his sword, goes to Philadelphia. I mean, this is a real critical moment in our history. Now, nothing really happens, and therefore, everything, historians have difficulty taking everything seriously when nothing, of all the fears, nothing really happens. So,
it's interesting. It's interesting. I mean, you, in a way, you've sort of shed maybe some more color for me on the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, because if there is this fear of invasion, then Jefferson's act becomes a way of, could be seen as a way of incapacitating the federal government in its ability to act.
Right. Oh, no, he's definitely frightened of the federal government. And so those resolutions of Virginia and Kentucky are quite serious. Now, fortunately, the other states don't join them. And then, of course, the whole thing collapses with the convention that Adams is able to achieve with France in 1799. I think that Jefferson's, you know, he was fortunate that he sent his draft over to Kentucky, and somebody in the Kentucky legislature took out the word nullification. But Jefferson is really anticipating the nullification movement of the antebellum period, and that word gets dropped, and it saves Jefferson's reputation, because it would have really been embarrassing later if he had used that term. That term had remained in the resolution.
Do you just curious? I mean, this is off topic. Do you situate the Virginia resolutions to be different in some respects from the Kentucky, or basically in line and keeping?
Madison's resolution written for Virginia is more moderate than Jefferson's. Jefferson's is very, very radical. I mean, both of them are radical, but the degree of radicalness is much greater with Jefferson's resolution. He is a much more radical person than Madison. Mm-hmm. And so Madison's softens some of his statements and makes his resolution a much more moderate statement than Jefferson's.
Thinking here, so it seems, I mean, as I'm reading your book and thinking about the split between Adams and Jefferson, the friendship undone for a while, as I run through it, is it so much the Federalist Party program, the way we think of it as commerce, banking, finance, manufacturing? Because it seems to me, as I'm reading your book, Adams wasn't as connected to that. It seems to me it really does come down to, we've been talking about it in one political manifestation, but really questions about human nature and how constitutions and law respond to that. And France and the revolution seems to be running through all of this.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And there are differences over their equality and human nature are much more serious than their policy differences. Adams is not a hardline Federalist, and actually under Jefferson's presidency he comes to support, as his son does as well, John Quincy Adams, comes to support the Louisiana Purchase, which is an anathema to the New England Federalists. They're frightened to death of all this territory, which is going to be Jeffersonian Republican, and the embargo. Actually, Adams and John Quincy in the Senate, John Quincy votes for the embargo. Now, Adams thought it was a temporary measure, and he thought the whole idea that using economic sanctions as a permanent way of dealing with, as an alternative to war, and a long-term alternative to war, was kind of silly. But he does support the embargo, at least as a temporary measure. So he is alienated from his fellow Federalists, and he ends up in the middle somewhere, and makes it easier for the reconciliation when it occurs, because Adams is halfway between the hardline Federalists, the Hamiltonian Federalists, and the Jeffersonian Republicans. So it makes the reconciliation, I think, possible.
Do you see that? I mean, thinking, I have no, just sort of conjecture on my part, Adams' background in farming and you know, being, I mean, he was a successful lawyer, but lawyering around Massachusetts, someone more rooted, not necessarily, I think of Hamilton as sort of, you know, an immigrant to the country and someone who is very much, I think he's able to think about or emancipated to think about America in a much more fulsome way. Adams, maybe circumstances led him not to be so open to thinking about finance and capital defining the country.
That's true. I mean, neither Jefferson nor Adams understands banking. Very few people did. Hamilton did understand what a bank was, although he had no anticipation of the kind of multiplication of state banks that occurred. That is not at all what he wanted. He wanted the Bank of the United States with its branches. He wanted to put these state banks out of business. He thought all the paper money that's flying around was just bad. And of course, Adams and Jefferson both really do not understand banks at all. I mean, Adams felt that if a bank issued more paper than it had gold and silver to back it up, then it was a cheat. And Jefferson's the same way. Neither man really understood what we would call the capitalist economy that was emerging, particularly in the North. I mean, all that paper money is capital. That's the source of the economic bonanza that America became. And Little Rhode Island, my own state, which was notorious both as a colony and as a state for printing paper money, was actually building itself to become an economic powerhouse in the 19th century because it had all this capital flying around. So I think neither man really understood what was happening in the country. And certainly Adams didn't, even though he's a Northerner. And Jefferson, of course, is totally out of touch. He's becoming really more and more defensive of his slave-ridden southern plantation economy and frightened to death of what the North represented and the anti-slave movements that were developing. Jefferson's last years are really kind of sad because those volumes are going to be published now over the next 5 or 6 years. They're going to be terribly embarrassing for Jeffersonian files, people who love Jefferson, because he really sounds like a Southern fire eater of the 1840s and 50s. He's just scared to death of Northern consolidation and what it means for the South and its system, meaning slavery. It's not that he favors slavery, he just doesn't know what to do about it, but he certainly fears the North's interference with their way of life.
Maybe talk about here the reconciliation as that happens and sort of how they do reconcile with one another.
Well, the reconciliation is in some senses superficial because they avoid... They're so interested in keeping it, keeping the thing going that they avoid, as I say, provoking too far, provoking each other. Jefferson never says anything to Adams that's controversial. Adams pushes the envelope here and there, but as I say, with slavery, he holds back. He doesn't go too far. But in every other way, on the French Revolution and on the Philosophes and all, and Jefferson's pie-in-the-sky visions of what the world ought to be, he doesn't hold back on that. He lets him know that he thinks he and all of his followers were living in a dream world. Adams is the ultimate realist. He's a real conservative, and I must say I find my own sensibility closer to Adams, although I've been accused by reviewers of being pro-Jeffersonian.
You were accused on our site, Gordon. Did you read that?
I know. I don't understand that.
I don't have a dog in this fight, but I read that review. That was interesting.
Yeah. Oh, this is by
Brad Thompson.
Brad Thompson. Oh, yeah. Now, Brad, well, he's a former student of mine. I think he's just so wrapped up in Adams that he thought I was being anti-Adams, and it's not true. I'm much more sympathetic to Adams. I do think the country has endorsed Jefferson, and for good reasons. You know, Adams believed that all men are created unequal. Now, that may be true, But the way we've survived and the way we've handled the masses of immigrants over the last few centuries is based on our belief that all men are created equal and that the differences that emerge, we don't deny differences, are due to environment. And therefore, education is important. Yeah. If we can give everybody the proper education, we can make for a greater equality. Now, Adams would say that's just hogwash. It's crazy.
Now, I thought. Now let me just pose. I'll be Brad Thompson. He says in the review, Adams believed everyone was equal in freedom or and had the capacity to be self-governing, but not equal in all respects.
He believes that everybody has equal rights.
Yeah.
Under law, that's true. But I would say
that's probably, as I think about key founders framework, I think that's probably the consensus. But it's not that we're equal in every respect.
Well, then, but we put an awful lot of emphasis on education. Head Start. We feel that if we can somehow give everybody a good education, we can equalize.
We have. I mean, that's part of the Great Society, but that's seen, I mean.
Well, I think Adams is, look, if you start from the assumption that people are born unequal and education can't do much about it, then we're wasting a lot of resources. That education is not going to make much of a difference.
So that's where they differ.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really conservative position. And Brad doesn't do justice to Adams's belief in inequality. He said he went to a founder, he tells Jefferson, he's really insistent on this point because he writes it to Jefferson, he writes it to Taylor. I went to a foundling hospital and I saw babies 4 days old. And some of them were smart, some of them were stupid. Some were beautiful and some were ugly. He's really insisting on that. We don't do that. Americans don't do that because it's too scary. Yeah. We cannot believe that. Yeah. And so we maybe we're kidding ourselves. Maybe we're living with a lie, but that is certainly what we don't believe that. We believe that everybody should have a chance and that maybe if with the proper education, we can all even things out. Yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't put so much emphasis on education.
But I think your point is well taken, and the American aspect of that is obviously true. I think, I mean, and I don't know enough about Adams' thought, but I think it seems, as I look at Adams and reading your book, I mean, and this is sort of my final question to you, which is what you've kind of answered is, you know, why have we seemingly appropriated Jefferson more so than Adams, and it seems to me Adams is actually more of an American than Jefferson in the way he lived and thought.
Well,
and
that's right. He comes from more egalitarian societies.
Yeah, but Adams, as you said, I mean, think about the founding hospital comment. I mean, one can think that, but at the same time, as long as I'm not putting undue burdens legally in your way, and I'm protecting your rights equally with others, I think Adams probably was at that position, but I don't know.
Adams was the realist. But look, America is not a realist society. We live with dreams. We live with utopian visions. We believe we're a special country. We believe we have a special role to play in the world. Many people believe that. Jefferson believed in American exceptionalism. Yeah. Adams did not. He said, we are just like other countries. We're just as corrupt. We're just as sinful. That's just not been an American belief. Yeah. So in every myth, Adams challenged every single American myth, every single American dream. He's an ultimate realist. Now, I happen to believe that he's right. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that any country could live with that realism.
Yeah.
That's too brutal. It's too honest.
Yeah,
we could never live with that. That's why Jefferson has become our hero. It was Lincoln's hero. Lincoln could not have gone back and appealed to all honor to Mr. Adams. How could he have done that and brought the country together? It wouldn't have worked.
True. Although Lincoln, many would argue, is sort of refounding the country beyond even what's intended.
Right, but he does appeal to Jefferson. Yeah. Jefferson is the founder, and it's the Declaration of Independence and the view of all men are created equal that he grabs hold of.
So maybe as I'm listening to you and thinking, I mean, anyway, I think of the way Herbert Hoover talked about American exceptionalism as we were exceptional in our liberty. But it wasn't necessarily an exceptionalism that one could or seek to.
Well, obviously, everyone's starting to modify this because it can get embarrassing. But that's not what Jefferson said.
Yeah.
He said, "We are the last best hope. We are a special nation," and that's Woodrow Wilson said the same thing. Now, you don't have to agree with that, and not every American has agreed, but it has been a major theme in American history that we are an exceptional nation.
Certainly a Cold War theme.
Yeah, and Adams denies that from the outset, and Jefferson stands for it.
Think about Adams' example here of work and labor on behalf of the Revolution. Away from, as you know, I mean, and I forget, you know, but he's away from his wife and his children for years at a time. He'll come back and visit them briefly, and then off again. He's laboring for something there. I mean, he's not just laboring to be like any other country, I think.
Oh, no, I agree. He believes in the revolution.
Yeah.
He believes that he ultimately, when he's confronted with these visions, which he considers utopian, Jefferson's statements that we're a special nation, he says, that's crazy. And we're just as liable to be corrupt. We're just as liable to be sinful. And he's realistic about that. He's realistic about human nature. We're not special. We're not going to get. And so I think that's where Adams is the real conservative.
So maybe the wisdom then is getting close to Adams, but not necessarily embracing or rolling around in what he said, but keeping it in mind as we live our American lives.
Yeah, well, we have to have both men.
We need both.
And that's why they make a nice pair.
Yeah. Professor Wood, thank you. This has been a great discussion. The book is Friends Divided, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.